This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Broadway's big awards ceremony, the Tony Awards, is this weekend. One of today's guests, Scott Rudin, is the lead producer of five of the nominated shows. In the category of Best Play, The Humans. Best Musical, Shuffle Along. And Best Revivals, The Crucible, A View from the Bridge, and Blackbird. Rudin was the lead producer of one of Broadway's biggest recent hits, The Book of Mormon. And Rudin is an EGOT, the acronym for the chosen few who have won an Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. He's produced dozens of films, including Steve Jobs, The Grand Budapest Hotel, Top Five, Captain Phillips, There Will Be Blood, and No Country for Old Men. Terry spoke with Rudin last Monday. Let's start with the new musical Shuffle Along, which is about the making of the 1921 musical Shuffle Along, the first hit Broadway show written and performed by African Americans. The new show stars Audra McDonald and includes songs from the original 1921 Shuffle Along by composer Ubi Blake and lyricist Noble Sissel. To get a sense of how the music sounded in its time, let's hear something from a new album called Sissel and Blake Sing Shuffle Along, which collects recordings from the 1921 show, featuring performances by Sissel and Blake, as well as members of the original cast. Here's Blake and original cast member Harold Browning performing the show's hit, I'm Just Wild About Harry.
I'm just wild about
Okay, and that was the composer Ubi Blake at the piano on that version of I'm Just Wild About Harry. Scott Rudin, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's start with why Shuffle Along was so important in its time.
Well, it was the first African-American musical, the first musical that used jazz. It developed ragtime into jazz. It's the first musical that was written, produced, created, and played entirely by a black company. That was a really remarkable thing in its time. And it was the first show that was really a book show that had an actual story. It had a love story between two African-American characters, which had never happened on Broadway before. And it was, in a way, the original DIY musical. It was made entirely by the people who starred in it, played it, created it, financed it. They did everything. And that was, in its time, was a really remarkable thing. And it had an extraordinary level of success at a period in which shows routinely would run 2 months and be considered successful. This show ran well over a year, and that was really unheard of at the time.
And there are several performers who performed in Shuffle Along who went on to become quite famous.
Yeah, Paul Robeson, Adelaide Hall, Josephine Baker, Hall Johnson, who created the choir that was in the original production of Porgy and Bess. Really remarkable constellation of artists played the show, were in the original production, then came in as replacements, then came in revivals. It was a sort of locus of the major African-American artists of its time.
So I think initially the idea was supposed to be a revival of Shuffle Along, but the way it's worked out is that it's more of a backstage musical about the making of Shuffle Along. And I'm guessing that the book itself for the original musical wasn't something that you all really wanted to revive once you examined it, because it's based on a vaudeville act by the two men who
Aubrey Lyles and Flournoy Miller, exactly.
Right, who worked often with Ubi Blake and Noble Sissel. And, you know, it's a vaudeville act from the late teens or early 20s about the
exactly.
mayor of Jimtown. And,
that's
you know,
right.
Going back and looking at it, it must have In spite of the fact that it was written by two African-American men, it still must have had so many stereotypes, because you kind of had to have stereotypes at the time, I think.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. I mean, in a way, it had aspects of a lot of things that came before it. Some portions of it were like a minstrel show. Some portions of it were like a kind of ragtime opus. It had a very thin story, mm-hmm. a kind of interesting story, but a very thin story with very few actual events. So it was very hard to start to figure out, could you get from A to B to C to D and get through an entire evening on who's going to be the next mayor of Jimtown? And what happened as we were sort of playing with that was the more we got into looking hard at, could you actually do Shuffle Along? The story of Shuffle Along took over. So you'd hear a song that they were working on, you'd see them write it, see them teach it to the people who were in it in the performance, and then repurpose it later in a different way. So the whole kind of ethos of the show, the strategy of the show, is a kind of very meta experience of this musical talking to itself as an example of a show made in 1921, and that material then repurposed as a show about the creators of the show in 1921. And what I think it's really about, the thing that I found very moving about it, and really why I was interested in doing it, the most interesting part of it to me, was they became successful based on their nerve and their drive and their grit. And they pushed and pushed and pushed, and they went on this crazy pre-Broadway tour where they were running out of money all the time. They came into New York, $18,000 in debt, which was the equivalent of about $250,000. Now, that's more than shows cost then. So they were really on fumes, and they were so much in debt that the only thing they could do was keep going, because if they ever stopped, they'd owe all that money. But the thing that I thought was so moving about it was that they had the equipment to get in the room, and they taught themselves how to get in the room. What they couldn't do on their own was figure out how to stay in the room, because it had never happened for African-American artists before, and that's what broke them up.
Well, I want to play another song that's from Shuffle Along. It's in the new Shuffle Along, and it's, of course, in the original Shuffle Along. And this is actually a 1921 recording. It's a recording from the year Shuffle Along opened on Broadway. And we're going to hear Ubi Blake, the composer, at the piano, and Noble Sisso, the lyricist, singing. And the song is called Love Will Find a Way. And this is a very important song. Scott, why don't you explain the song's importance?
Well, it has a historical importance because it was the first time a love song was sung by a black man to a white woman and by a black woman to a white man. It never happened before.
On stage, and on a Broadway stage.
On stage,
on a Broadway
exactly.
stage,
and
yeah.
Yes, that's right. Although, in fact, when they put the song in the show, they weren't on Broadway yet. They were out of town. And they were out of town in the South, where the particular dangers of what they were doing were even more pronounced. So it was an act of kind of remarkable bravery. And there were numerous examples of black performers being tarred and feathered and being driven out of town and being arrested and being beaten for basically not essentially following the rules of, you know, of what was available in terms of behavior for black people at the time. So for these artists to say, we're telling a love story, we're going to write a love song, and Lottie G is going to sing it to this guy in the show, and we're going to tough it out. And they did. But there was an enormous amount of tension about, were they going to end up in jail by the end of the night?
Okay, so let's hear the song. And this is Love Will Find a Way. And the composers Noble Sisso and Ubi Blake are performing it, recorded in 1921.
The
That's so fantastic.
Isn't that, recorded in 1921. Yeah. That's Cecil and Blake. Part of the story of Shuffle Along, you know, it's about the making of the 1921 musical Shuffle Along. So part of the story is about what Broadway was like in 1921, yes. The year Shuffle Along was produced. Shuffle Along opened on Broadway in a theater that wasn't exactly a Broadway theater. It was on 63rd Street. It was incredibly shabby and run down. There was no orchestra pit. The stage was a mess. There were no dressing rooms. So in your musical, one of the characters says, well, what defines Broadway is the price of a ticket. So let's just raise the price of a ticket, and then we're a Broadway show. So is that what defines the difference between Broadway and off-Broadway?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's a joke. There's obviously some truth to it. I mean, I think we're living in a time in which the price of tickets has gotten completely insane. And the thing that makes it very hard to wrangle as an issue is plays have, especially for plays have limited shelf lives. So you end up with, you do a new play or you do a revival of a play and you've got 14 weeks or 16 weeks or if you're incredibly lucky, 20 weeks. So in order to make the venture make any financial sense, the price has to stay relatively high. And what ends up happening, and we face this all the time, we face this in the first couple of years of the Book of Mormon, it was an endless source of frustration and disappointment, which was, you know, we kept a low price ticket in the building. We had two or three rows of $69 tickets. This is when we were selling tickets at that point for $499, and we kept this low price. We put it on sale in a very specific way, so we could keep it out of the hands of the brokers. And there was absolutely no way to get it to the audience. The single ticket buyer could not get their hands on that ticket. In the same way, I'm sure Hamilton is having the exact same problem now. It's very, very tough to beat back the scalpers. And on one hand, they are your customers. On another hand, they keep the single ticket buyer. They keep the audience members who are the fans of theater, who are sensitive to a price point and don't have the ability to spend $150 for one ticket or for premiums substantially more than that. They keep those people out of the building. So it's a problem that every hit show, especially hit shows, face.
Are the scalpers so vigilant that as soon as tickets open up, they buy them and then sell them for more?
They will buy them before they open up. I mean, here's an interesting story. There's a broker who has become a very close friend of mine, who I met because it was the year that the Book of Mormon opened. It was at Christmas. And I was sitting in my office, and a huge deli platter arrived in my office, you know, followed by this endless parade of bagels and bialys and lox and cream cheese and all this, with a note saying, "You bought me a house in Connecticut. The least I can do is buy you lunch." And it came from a broker who I like enormously, who was in possession at the time of 30,000 tickets to the Book of Mormon. And that's a remarkable thing. And he taught me how they work and what they want and also how to manage pricing.
So tell us one of the tricks that scalpers use to buy up a lot of tickets that they could sell at higher
prices. They have thousands of credit cards. I mean, it's all computerized. So when a new block of tickets goes on sale for a show, they frequently crash the system because they have so much ability to get in. You know, and the theater owners try to be as vigilant about this as they can, and they try to kick back purchases that come from area codes they know or zip codes that they know are broker area codes and zip codes, but it doesn't work. They get through, and it's very hard to know what to do about them because, as I said, they are customers. They're buying tickets. They're keeping the theater full, but at the same time, you don't really want anyone else in control of your inventory. Your inventory is the lifeblood of what you do.
Let's talk about your story. You started working on Broadway when you were 16. How did you get to do that?
I was actually 15. I went to work for a summer in the office of two producers named Manny Eisenberg and Gene Walsk. Gene Walsk has since died. Manny Eisenberg is still remarkably active and brilliant and a kind of legendary figure. And I wrote them a letter saying, "Can I come and work in your office? I'll answer the phone. I'll do anything. You don't have to pay me. I'll be there for the summer. I'll be there as long as you want." And I did that for them, and I just loved it and never looked back. And I'm honestly a complete product of mentorship.
So you have a reputation of being, you know, a very demanding boss and of sometimes having quite a temper. When you were 15 and 16 and you were working with these theater giants, how did they treat you?
Some great, some not so great. But honestly, I didn't care. I mean, it was better when they were great because it was easier. But the quid pro quo of the exposure to what they were doing against being batted around a little bit, who cares? I mean, it meant it was meaningless to me. I mean, when I worked for Kermit Blumgarden, he had had cancer a few years before I was there, and he had an artificial leg. And he was unhappy with the way the leg was bending, and he called me into his bedroom, took off his pants, took off his leg, and told me to go and get it fixed. And wouldn't give me cab fare, made me take it on the bus. So, but you know what? What do I care? I mean, it was probably the greatest day of my life. I can't think of anything that's been better than that, honestly. I used to have to pick tomato worms off the plants in his garden, but you know what? He was producing Equus. He had produced all these extraordinary plays. I learned more from him than I probably learned from anybody in my life for years since then.
One of the first things you did along the way to becoming the producer you became was to be the casting director.
Mm-hmm.
You were involved with the casting of Annie.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested in that because, first of all, you were very young. How young?
18.
Okay. And you're casting, I don't know if you cast Annie or any of the substitutes for Andrew McCarthy.
I cast many Annies.
Oh, yeah.
Not Andrew McCarthy.
How do you cast children? That must be especially hard because for a lot of reasons. First of all, their voices aren't developed yet, and you don't know how their voices are going to change, even girls. And also, you're involving their parents.
The parents were always very complicated because I used to get letters from mothers saying, "Dear Mr. Rudin, my daughter is 8 years old. She sings really well. We also have a dog who could play Sandy." So, you know, they were selling any member of the family indiscriminately. They didn't care who it was. If you want the dog, they'll supply the dog. If you want the kid, you can have the kid. So it's funny you bring up the singing because what happened with Annie, the specific case of that, was it really changed the way girls sang. So once it became a hit, every girl wanted to sound like Andrew McArdle. So it was very easy to find girls who could belt Tomorrow because that's all they wanted to do. But, you know, I mean, the toughest thing about the Annie situation was there was a ruler backstage on one of the walls, and when somebody hit 5 feet, they were gone. I mean, didn't matter who it was, Andrew McArdle or somebody playing Pepper. You know, you were just out of the show when you hit that height, and it was merciless. And so, I mean, there were a lot of crying girls and crying mothers.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So you tend to be, I think, in the active range of producer, taking a very, like, active role in making suggestions and watching what the directors and actors are up to.
Mm-hmm.
If you were the director, would you want someone as active as you being the producer, or would you want them, like, out of the room?
Well, sometimes people do want you out of the room. Depending on who the person is, sometimes being out of the room is great and entirely appropriate. I mean, you know, when I make movies with the Coen brothers, they don't want anybody in the room. You know, we work on the script, but really the script is theirs. I take care of my portion of it, which is making sure that it's financed and making sure that we're selling it, sometimes finding the material, sometimes working with them on the cut. It can vary, but you don't need to be everything. I mean, sometimes it's really great not to be in the room, and sometimes your value is that you're not in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And that you come in to see the thing when it's formed. I had a really interesting experience this year on The Crucible because we did two shows with the Belgian director Ivo van Hove. One was View from the Bridge, which I saw in London and loved and brought here, and the other was The Crucible, which was the first production he did that was done specifically for Broadway. And we had a run-through of The Crucible. I hadn't seen any of it in the room because he got behind in rehearsal, and there was a run-through, and the run-through was the same night as the invited dress of Shuffle Along. So I went to Shuffle Along, and some of the people on the Crucible team went to Crucible. And I had said to them, just come back to Shuffle when Crucible's over and find me and tell me what kind of shape we're in. So 2 hours go by, nobody. 3 hours go by, nobody's there. 3.5 hours go by, nobody's shown up. At like 4 hours and 20 minutes, they all walk in, and they're looking so shell-shocked and so terrified that I thought, what the hell did you see that did this to you? And they said, it's endless. It doesn't work. It's amorphous. It doesn't have any drive. I went the next night, and I thought it was one of the greatest things I'd ever seen. It was just too long. So sometimes you have a certain body of knowledge, which is experiential, which is being able to look at something and say, okay, the problem here is not a problem of execution. The problem here isn't a problem of it being qualitatively good enough. It's just too long. So get it to move faster, get the sets on and off faster, get the intermissions shorter, get the scene changes shorter, drive it. And I felt I made a big contribution to that show by basically making sure nobody panicked, because there was so much panic happening around it and none of it was necessary. And honestly, that's what I did. I did that and basically said to everybody, this is going to be great. We have 4 weeks of previews. Relax and do your work.
How do you keep the joy in the things that you really love, like movies, television, and shows, when there's so much at stake and there's so much stress involved with the work? I mean, like, well, as much as you love a show, you have your money riding on it, you have investors' money riding on it, and you have the careers and the futures of everybody in that show riding on it.
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, one of the reasons that I went into movies was because I frankly thought at the time, and I was really young when I did this, that I thought I loved the theater too much to ever be unromantic about it. And I didn't have that feeling for movies. I love individual movies. I love making stuff. I like making movies. I like working with great collaborators. But movies as a form never were a big thing for me. And I thought, I'll be good at this because I don't care about it. You know, in other words, not that I don't care about what I'm doing, but I don't have a passionate interest in the forum. I have a deeply passionate interest in the theater, which made me worry that I wouldn't be good at it. So it took me a long time to want to produce in the theater because I was afraid of it. And I was afraid that I would be too in love with something to be good for it. And what I learned was I was wrong about that. And at the same time, that my love for it has an actual kind of provable value. Yeah, the risk is intense and the stress is intense, but I think the chance to make something great so balances the equation in its favor that it honestly is never much of an issue for me, because I don't really start to do something that I don't think is going to work and is going to be really good.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Film and Broadway producer Scott Rudin. He was the lead producer of 5 shows that are up for this year's Tony Awards. He spoke with Terry last Monday. Our rock critic, Ken Tucker, has a review of soul singer William Bell's new album called This Is Where I Live. Bell first had a hit with the song You Don't Miss Your Water in 1961. Bell co-wrote the classic blues song Born Under a Bad Sign and recorded R&B music frequently for Stax Records in the 1960s and 70s. Ken says the new album can stand with the best of Bell's work.
There was a time when nothing held you down. You wanted it all, from the sky to the ground. Now all along you thought you were free, but that's not the way it turned out to be. 'Cause when you're tired,
William Bell sings with a warmth that remains undimmed more than 50 years after his first hit. He was never a huge star, but for anyone aware of his work, he's been a constant, steady source of pleasure, a singer whose sense of intimacy with his audience forms a direct connection. At his best, William Bell can seem to be inside your mind, articulating hopes, fears, and doubts you may have had yourself. You can hear that connection on the song that leads off This Is Where I Live, a song about conflicting aspects of personality called The Three of Me.
Last night I had a dream, and there were three of me. There was the man I was, the man I am, and the man I want to be. It's not that easy.
Bell goes over some of the specifics of his career in the album's title tune, one of the rare autobiographical songs that conveys its information without tedium or boastfulness. He also sings with infinite compassion and tenderness on another song, the achingly vulnerable and protective, I Will Take Care of You.
When all the years have come and gone and laid you low, you should know
when you think you left out on your own, I will be there. I never gave you fancy clothes, no diamond rings or the finer things, but when you feel all alone, don't you despair. I will take care of you. Oh, yes, I will. I will take care of you.
The triumph of This Is Where I Live cannot be separated from the production by John Leventhal. Leventhal has managed to make the music here sound as though it was recorded just yesterday, but also perhaps a half century ago. The drums have that classic moist Memphis soul thump. The guitars ring out with a stinging precision that underscores the pain in Bell's voice and lyrics. One great showcase for the sound on this album can be heard on a song Bell and Leventhal co-wrote, the metaphorically clever and poignant More Rooms.
Remember on our wedding day, I carried you in my arms through the front door of this house, vowing to keep you from harm. In love forever we'd always be. We had plans for a family. The fire was burning hot, but ashes was all we got. Don't you know there's more rooms in a house? And the bedroom.
Listen to the way Bell and his producer take a song by Leventhal and Roseanne Cash, Walking on a Tightrope, and turn it into something that sounds like a 1960s soul hit you've never heard before. I agree with Greil Marcus's remark, can't Leventhal have Cash and Bell make their next album together?
You can slam the door and walk from here to Georgia. You can burn old friends till one by one they fall. You can spend your last thin dime trying to make yourself feel fine. You can cry through every story, but I've heard them all.
There's no need to approach This Is Where I Live as an item of nostalgia. Throughout this album, William Bell sings with a strength and directness that bypasses any suggestion that you might need to make some allowances for a man who's now in his mid-70s. Instead, there's a careful power that uncoils steadily as the album proceeds. It's the sound of a man seizing an opportunity and making it a challenge that he turns into a triumph.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed William Bell's new album, This Is Where I Live. Coming up, we talk about Silicon Valley, HBO's comedy series about the tech industry, with the show's star, Thomas Middleditch, its creator, Mike Judge, and co-showrunner, Alec Berg. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Born under a bad sign, I've been down since I began to crawl. Oh, if it wasn't for bad luck, I wouldn't have no luck at all. Hard luck and trouble, my only friend.
Our next guests are from the HBO comedy series Silicon Valley, which satirizes the creative and cutthroat world of tech startups. The tech companies that have become giants, and the programmers, coders, marketing people, CEOs, and venture capitalists who inhabit that world. Mike Judge is the co-creator of Silicon Valley and created the animated shows Beavis and Butthead and King of the Hill. Alec Berg is the co-showrunner with Judge. Berg also has been an executive producer of Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. Thomas Middleditch stars in Silicon Valley as Richard Hendricks, the brilliant but shy and socially awkward creator of a startup called Pied Piper, which has created an algorithm to compress and store huge amounts of data, an innovation that would change the ability to speedily access data around the world. At the end of last season, after a Pied Piper fiasco, the board removed Richard from his position as CEO of his own company because of his lack of business and leadership skills. At the start of the current season, Richard was replaced by a new CEO, Jack Barker, and reluctantly accepted the offer to work as Jack's chief technology officer. In this scene, Jack, played by Stephen Tobolowsky, is showing Richard a poster of his business model, which he calls the conjoined triangles of success, diagramming the inner relationship of manufacturing, engineering, sales, growth, and compromise. Richard, played by Thomas Middleditch, speaks first.
The conjoined triangles of success?
I invented that, and now it's taught at business schools. You see what's on the bottom here? The foundation of the whole thing.
Growth?
Growth. The more brilliant people we can get working here, then the faster we can get whatever is in your head out into the world. Let me tell you a story. In 1999, Google was a little startup just like we are. And when they started bringing in chefs and masseuses, we thought, they're nuts! But they were attracting the best possible people, and they were able to create the best product, and now they're worth over $400 billion. And do you know the name of that company?
Google, right? You said it at the beginning of the story.
You're right. I did that wrong. And the whole point is that all of this is a sound investment as long as we are able to get the best people and make the best possible product.
Yeah, this is the scene from Silicon Valley. Mike Judge, Alec Berg, Thomas Middleditch, welcome to Fresh Air. Mike, let me start with you. Why did you want to do a show about Silicon Valley? You created King of the Hill, an animated series about a kind of old-fashioned, middle-aged, working-class guy who probably wouldn't know how to work a computer. So, like, the distance between King of the Hill and Silicon Valley is huge. Of course, King of the Hill is animated, too. Another big difference.
Yeah. And then Beavis and Butthead may be even further away from computer geniuses. But, I'd worked as an engineer a long time ago and just have been around the tech world a lot. My ex-wife's from Palo Alto, and I had spent a lot of time there and actually lived up there and worked up there. So it's pretty far from King of the Hill, but it's something that's kind of I've been close to a lot of my life.
Alec Bird, what is your connection to the Silicon Valley, if any?
yes. Well, going back, my father is a biophysicist who builds his own microscopes. My brother was an electrical engineer who has worked at Microsoft and now works at Amazon. So I have some sort of nerd cred in my bones.
Is your family ever offended at the Silicon Valley jokes?
I don't know that my parents even know that the show's on television, to be honest. I get requests every once in a while for VHS copies of the show. I think they're amused that my name is on a television show that goes out to people, but I don't think they're of that world enough to ever take offense at anything we're doing.
Wait, was it your brother who works for Amazon?
Yeah.
Is he offended at the jokes?
Well, in the interest of advancing his career at Amazon, let's say he polices it very carefully and he speaks up strongly for the rights of Amazon at every possible opportunity. And I hope that gets him further in his job.
Thomas Middleditch, what's your connection to the real Silicon Valley?
Oh, very little. Very, very little. I guess my only connection is growing up. And still to this day, I'm still a bit of a computer kid. I do like my games and my trinkets and my gadgets. But I never really took time to program or anything. I came into this project totally from the point of view as pretty much just an actor of just trying to get Richard down, and not really a good actor because I didn't go to Silicon Valley and like research anyone or anything. I just sort of came in there with and took a stab at it, and it happened to be on point.
So the invention that Richard's company, and Richard's played by Thomas Middleditch, his thing is high compression cloud storage data. So in other words, you could like compress all the data in the world into a small amount of storage, store it on the cloud. It's not a sexy idea in the way that a new gizmo is sexy. You know, and it's like a hard thing to like demonstrate at a show in the way that Steve Jobs would demonstrate like the new iPhone or the iPad. So Mike and Alec, how did you come up with, you know, compression as the thing that the show is going to revolve around?
Well, part of the problem originally when we were writing the pilot is you go, okay, well, whatever app they come up with, if it's really to be believable that this app is successful and in demand and huge, you would have to believe it would be that way in the real world. It's sort of like when you do, if you're doing a movie about a band and then they have a song that's supposed to be a hit, that song has to really be a hit in the real world. Otherwise, the whole thing seems fake. And I just remember from school that compression was kind of an interesting thing, that there's different kinds, and still, especially in video, there's still probably room for something that could really compress it more. And I think it's realistic. You know, I talked to some of my old engineer friends, and they said, yeah, it's still possible that somebody could come up with a game-changing algorithm in that space, you know. So it seemed like something that's just, you know, people basically understand file size, because that's what, you know, when you buy a computer or your phone, you're paying for that. So, and it is sexy, I think, but, you know, what do I know?
Well, the nice thing about it for you guys is it's invisible. You know, like you can't like show data storage that, you know, compressed data that exists in the cloud. So you don't have to create a product for us to see.
Yeah, I also think that it being compression, it being sort of like an under-the-hood invention or whatever, that adds to the show's credibility. It makes it sort of for us, by us, you know, in terms of engineers and math people, which I think is a huge draw for the show. I mean, there's very little, you know, Twitter hate of like, hey, you got that wrong. If anything, it's like, implausible. Let me show you with my math how it could have been done. But it's never, you know, flag on the play, I call foul, absolutely impossible. And some of our consultants, I don't know who we can name, Doten maybe.
Yeah.
He thinks compression is like one of the biggest challenges we're going to face, because right now we have massive data storage centers, you know, these big warehouses, and there is a finite amount of space that we can do, and we're exponentially requiring more and more each year with every new cloud storage service site and every new way to create content. You have to store it somewhere, so some kind of like accessible, executable compression is actually a pretty revolutionary thing.
This season, it looks like your character, Thomas, your character of Richard, is going to have a girlfriend, or at least it briefly looks that way. But but you have a big fight about whether it's better to use the tab key on the computer or to tap out individual spaces. Would you explain what that fight is about and if people actually have that fight?
There's like memes of it's a big ongoing battle. I just got an email from my old roommate from college, who's an engineer up there for a pharmaceutical company, and he's like, "I just want you to know, I'm on the spaces side of that."
Yeah, it's funny when we were talking about the idea in the writers' room, one of our writers texted a friend who works for Apple, just saying, "Hey, is this tabs versus spaces thing real?" And his friend who worked at Apple was out at drinks with a bunch of other engineers, and she replied that A, it is real, and B, just talking about it now has sparked a giant violent debate, and they were actually screaming at each other in a bar about whether tabs or spaces were better. So it's very real and apparently extremely contentious.
Yeah, well, that speaks to the engineer brain, the the how do you structure your math? What do you feel is more efficient? And that, I mean, that is how Richard works, and that's how a lot of these people work in programming and engineering. It's like, you know, I feel like tab spaces can be synonymous with, I'm sure, a multitude of hot button issues. But that's exactly why I think this show, these writers, do so well at it, is like they bring in the material that's kind of real and relevant, and it's not like the fake Hollywood version of how people code. It's not like Hackers, where we go into a 3D realm and we like virtual reality interact with computers. It's like, no, this is a real debate of tabs versus spaces.
Well, you know, and the difference between tabs versus spaces in the show makes it seem like Richard prefers the tabs because they require less compression than the spaces. Is that what the argument is about in the larger world where people fight over this?
Well, Terry, some clarification here. It's also one keystroke as opposed to, what, eight?
Do the math
on that.
The argument, once it goes through the compiler and then it's completely the same thing once it's running. Jeremy Stoppelman at Yelp was telling us about a guy who was so anal about it, he went in on and spent an entire weekend converting everybody's tabs to spaces, or the other way around.
Yeah, I think when he came in and took over a project, yeah, he spent something like 48 straight hours just deleting spaces and adding tabs, even though, as we said, once it goes through the compiler, it's utterly irrelevant, apparently.
I just can't stand to see people doing that. And I guess the argument for the spaces is that if somebody else has their tabs set differently and you run it in theirs, then it throws it all off, and it's just, yeah, I think that's, the spaces is more pure.
I would just, Mike, why would you be adjusting the tab? I mean, what purpose is my point?
Okay, I'm going to storm out of here.
But one of the things we always try and do is, even though there is this very kind of technical debate going on, you know, we always try and turn it to what is sort of the most relatable part of it, which is that, you know, as long as the audience understands that these are two different things that are indistinguishable by most people,
right,
but that people are incredibly particular and, you know, violently specific about them.
At the beginning of each season, you go on a research trip to various parts of Silicon Valley to see what's happening and what you can learn that you might be able to write in some way in the new season. So how do you structure those trips?
We'll try and talk to engineers. We'll try and look at some big companies. We'll tour some small companies. We'll meet with some VCs, some attorneys. We try to sort of cast a wide net because we're finding, you know, we get interesting, really funny, weird story ideas from all different places, and there's no kind of rule as to where they come from.
So when you're observing in Silicon Valley, do you pay special attention to what the offices look like? For instance, in this season, Richard's company moved basically from house with their new CEO. They moved to this like big office that has like fabulous furniture and little game kind of things around, and a professionally curated micro kitchen. So,
yeah, that was actually, we were at Quora, and somebody had taken a watermelon, hollowed it out, and put watermelon jello in there and sliced it up like pieces of watermelon. We used that in the show. Yeah, there's a lot of details like that. Actually, Richard Toyon, our production designer, goes up there also and takes a lot of pictures. And
it is amazing when we tour companies how almost exactly like our sets they are.
It seems like you can't hyperbolize it for a joke hard enough.
Yeah.
I mean, even I did a brief visit at Google X, and they have these little push scooters that you can go from one end of the compound to the other, and the floors are very smooth to maximize efficiency of the push scooters. There are kitchens. There's very robust ways of eating.
Yeah.
To quote Tobolowsky, I want my coders hungry here and never here, pointing to his belly.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing.
I think it was Google, right? That they never wanted anyone more than 100 feet from food.
Those little food stations all
and,
over the place.
And then when we toured Google, they had this philosophy of, they've organized their offices to, and I think their phrase was, to hard code serendipitous moments, which basically meaning that, I mean, it was an incredibly unserendipitous, you know, way of saying that they wanted people who didn't know each other to be forced to interact with each other because who knows what could happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of, like, corporate harmony It's Namaste with a logo and everyone forced to be in a circle and say Namaste. But like, it's like,
That goes back to, it's interesting. It goes back to, I think, the whole philosophy. I mean, it's the Bay Area, right? It's like hippie culture that has run headlong into rampant capitalism.
Alec, one of the shows you worked on before Silicon Valley was Seinfeld. And I'm thinking, like, Silicon Valley is about like the high tech world. And one of the most famous episodes of Seinfeld is where George leaves a message on a girl's answering machine and realizes he wants to erase the message, and he has to like break into the house and try to steal the cassette from the answering machine so that she never gets the message. And when you think of the difference technology-wise between the answering machine plot and the file compression and storage plot, it's such a huge technological gap. Do you ever find yourself thinking about that?
Oh, sure. And a lot of times technology massively gets in the way of funny and interesting storytelling. Like, there's somebody put together a really interesting supercut on YouTube of instances in movies where people are just looking at their cell phones saying, there's no signal. Because so if you think about it, like, every kind of farcical story in the history of storytelling would be over if somebody just had a cell phone, right? And it's like, I'll just call them. You know, I don't have to go there. I don't, you know, and cell phones have destroyed so many good stories that people have just come up with this device of, oh, my battery's dead, or there's no signal. I mean, honestly, it's like a 9-minute long thing of there's no bars.
I never thought about that, how cell phones would be damaging to storytelling.
Well, look, we deal with that all the time. Like, Monica, who works at Reviga, comes over to the house to talk to the guys all the time. The reality is she probably would never set foot in that house. She'd just call them. But scenes are much more interesting to shoot and to play between humans who are interacting with each other as opposed to phone calls.
She wouldn't even call. She would text, right? I mean,
yeah, probably. Yeah. Right. Well, that's actually, it was funny when we first started doing the show. I remember somebody's, one of the first kind of reviews of it we read was that some angry tech guy was like, this show's totally unrealistic because in reality, they'd be texting way more. And we're like, all right, so if that's your knock on the show, is that people should be texting more?
That's what he wants to see.
Yeah. So fake. These people talking to each other and saying things and looking each other in the eye. Yeah,
and with that, he crawled back under his rock and went to bed.
At his mom's house.
Yeah. It's not my rock. It's actually my mom's rock.
Well, I want to thank all of you for talking with us. It's really been fun. Thanks for your series. I really enjoy it. And I wish you all well.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thomas Middleditch is the star of the HBO comedy series Silicon Valley. Mike Judge created it, and Alec Berg is the co-showrunner with Judge. They spoke with Terry last Thursday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.B. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inculi.